Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, I'm Ollie Dugmore, and this is Unfiltered. My guest today is a comedian. The product of a Catholic childhood in Ireland, she then moved to America. She's also an author, and her memoir, Trouble, is equal parts tender, hilarious, and raw, dealing with her sex work, addiction, and father's death by suicide. My guest today is Maurice Gorn. Maurice, hello. How's it going?
What an intro.
Happy?
That was the intro of my life. Yeah, I'm going to have that, you know, when you die.
You want it on your tombstone?
Yeah. Big tombstone, but yeah.
We can put it in a small font, it'll fit on there. Yeah. What have you been up to? How's things?
Good, sweating.
Mitchum.
Yeah, best deodorant in the biz.
Always.
Not even sponsored.
I wonder, maybe if the simplest thing for you to explain, like a little bit of your backstory is, rather than me to sort of be like, what happened here, what happened there, is for you to sort of tell me what your memoir's about, Trouble, fantastic book. Tell me about, yeah, your life and your recent years.
I find it so hard to describe the book because it's like about like quite intense subjects, but it's, I don't think it's like an intense book. I think it's like, I'm not trying to give, you know, life lessons or anything. So I think it's like an entertaining book, but to give the elevator pitch makes it sound really intense because it's about, I guess, suicide and sex, the two S's, two favorite S's.
What?
Like in a nutshell, if you're, how would you hear it as an animator, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much bang on. The SS,
yeah. Yeah, was there...
Actually as well, because that's got like a branding thing.
I know, but don't you need three?
No, I think... Stimulants?
Like cocaine?
Coke, yeah.
Oh yeah, that is in the book. I was about to be like, I've never done cocaine.
How dare you?
Yeah,
but Maurice, I read your memoir.
Well, I wrote the book when I was like drinking, so... Loads of parts I don't remember writing. Yeah, and like I'll read it and I'm just like, this is not bad. I wish I remembered it.
What's his chops? Stephen King says that.
Yeah, about...
Carrie.
Yeah.
He doesn't remember it because he was just coked off his head.
I know.
All the time.
It's... So interesting.
Was it method writing for you? Is that what you were channeling?
Well, you know that Hemingway quote that Barney didn't really say where he's like, write drunk, edit sober. So I used to always say that. But then I started doing like, write drunk, edit drunk.
Mm. That's good.
Yeah, well, then you have an editor, though. So, like, a lot of time, yeah, they'll just take out the last bit you wrote, like, at the end of the day, where you'll be talking about, like, I don't know, I wrote some mental things. But, yeah, I don't know, like, even in rehab, when they're like, alcohol is so bad, alcohol is the worst thing ever. I'm like, can we talk about the good things alcohol did? Because I did write a book drunk. Like, I didn't start drinking every day because it was shit. Nobody's addicted to fucking spinach, you know? There's, like... lots of good parts of it too.
It's interesting that you don't feel a degree of, I don't know, bitterness. I've met other people who've sort of, you know, had addictions in the past and they sort of are a little bit angry at themselves or maybe, I don't know, bitter about it. And you seem to suggest there that there's a degree of, I don't know, that you enjoyed a part of it.
Yeah, the bitterness is, I always think of, do you remember in Celebrity Big Brother when Michael Barrymore and George Calloway, was that his name?
Galloway,
the one licking out of the that was wild.
The cat, yeah.
Yeah. That's one of those ones, like the more you think about it, the crazier it is. Like, yeah. What was he doing? What's he up to? Anyway, so he said to Michael Barry, who's an alcoholic, like, pour me another, which I guess is an expression, but like, alcoholics, are, it's like the pour me Olympics. Mm. Like in rehab, I was, anytime you bring up anything that's ever happened to you, then everyone has to try and outdo each other. And there is like quite, I don't like that like poor me mentality. But a lot of people have that of like, it's so hard for me because I'm an addict and no one else understands it. And it's, everyone else has life. It's hard for everyone. Life is hard for everyone. Like, shut up and just don't drink. And I'm like, sometimes I'm jealous that people can drink normally because I would love that. I would I've had some of the best times drinking.
Little buzz, two drinks in or whatever, have a nice night.
Yeah, or even like five drinks. Like, any, you know, like it's summer, that's fun. In winter, that's like, there's, to drink regularly, I would like to do that. I just know I can't do that. And like, that's on me. That's not on alcohol. Alcohol hasn't done anything wrong. It's me that can't process it. Like some people say, like they treat alcohol like it's an allergy. They're like, it's an allergy for me. The people that are addicted to it, it's like, I can't process it. So blaming like alcohol for it is like, I find just a bit of a cop out. It's like, take some responsibility. And I think like, I don't know, I'm the happiest I've ever been right now, being sober. And I know that's from being sober. But it's also from like taking responsibility for my shit, you know, of like, oh, here's all the bad shit I've done. And that's on me. I can't blame alcohol for that. And there's some people in the programs that will say, you know, you can blame alcohol for everything. When I got into rehab, he was like, everything that happened before here, you can wipe clean. And I was like, what if when I wasn't drinking? What if I did it? Doesn't matter. Everything. And I was like, that's sick. I'll do that. But it's kind of a crazy way of thinking too.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. I don't know. Did I, like, I kind of went in a roundabout there.
No, it's fascinating. I'm really enjoying listening to you. It changed you, obviously, getting sober. And we will come back to sort of the early biography stuff, but I just want to enjoy this conversation a little bit further into it, which is, You've changed your relationship with yourself. I wonder if when you got sober, it changed your relationship with other people at all. Were there people who were kind of, I don't know, destructive to you, or even just like your friends when you weren't going and having a couple of pints? Maybe it changed your dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, that was something that was like, it didn't worry me, but I was told it was a big worry in rehab. You know, there's going to be a lot of people that you're going to have to cut out, and there's going to be a lot of like fake friends, your drinking buddies, all this stuff of like, I had this idea that, you know, I was going to have to cut out a lot of people. People weren't going to support this. And that's what they drilled into me. And at one stage, like, I was like, I'm going to have to cut out my own mother if it comes to it, you know, like they had, I was like, if she's not going to support this, I'm going to have to cut out mom. And then I got out and like literally not one person has said shit. Everyone has been so supportive. Even my like drinking friends that, you know, were friends because like we went out drinking all the time. Once I got sober, they're like, that's amazing. I'm really proud of you. And yeah, you should have stopped. Like that was so surprising to me that I was like, people, like, why did I expect so bad? Maybe I'm just lucky in that everyone that I'm friends with are nice. But everyone was so nice.
Mm-hmm.
And also it surprised me too, because I thought like, oh, other people, for the beginning at least, now I'm okay if people drink in front of me, if it's a group. I don't like it one-on-one. But at the beginning, I couldn't even be around alcohol at all, and I knew that.
Mm.
And I thought people, I was like, there's no way other people will be comfortable with that, because I know when I was drinking, if I went out and someone said, I don't drink and I don't really want you to drink when you're around me, I'd have been like, see you, I have to drink, like, goodbye. And everyone was fine with that. And it just made me realize, oh, it was just me that was drinking to excess. Like everyone else was like, I'm fine having a water. That's cool. So that was a really nice surprise as well, because I thought that would be way more difficult. Loads of people do it without even me asking them to. I remember going on a first date like last year and the girl just didn't drink. And I was like, you don't even know me. Like, you don't have to do this. Like, a first date is so awkward with a stranger anyway.
Mm.
Like, you can totally drink. And she's like, no, I won't drink. Like, you're not drinking, so I'll have a non-alcoholic beer too. Like, that is, people are fucking nice.
Mm, yeah.
What a surprise.
Yeah, I think generally, people are. You know, deep down, like most people, they want to be kind. They want to help. And I think, I don't know whether it's a product of the social media age we live in, or if that feels like a cheap cop-out to point it on, where everyone kind of thinks that the people around them are horrible and abusive. And in reality, the vast, vast majority of people you meet, they are kind hearted, they are pleasant, and they try to accommodate everyone they're around. I always find that.
Yeah, there's so much more good in people than bad.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree. Right, shall we chat a little bit about your early life then? Yeah? I always think it's good to begin at the beginning. So, you grew up in Dublin in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Catholic household.
Yeah.
Catholic mother.
Yeah.
Catholic school.
Yeah, run Catholic.
Run that shit, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, it was such a weird one growing up Catholic because you didn't know that there was any other option, but like God is used as like a real fear tactic when you're younger. Like everything was like, God's watching you. God's watching you. I remember like when I used to masturbate and I'd just be like, I'm so sorry, God.
You say out loud.
Yeah. And because my mom was like, God is watching every single thing you do. And then she used to add in people that were dead and people were always dying in Ireland. So I'd be like, in my head, it was God watching and like my granny, my cousin, like everyone was just watching dead. And I'll be like, I'm so sorry. God was just used as like a little punishment all the time.
For fuck's sake.
So I like never, when I hear of people who are religious now, like my boyfriend is quite Muslim. That's the expression, quite Muslim. But when he talks about God, I'm just like, what God were you raised in? Because like we're used to this terrifying God. Where his is all, you know, like God loves me and stuff. I was like, why is he? That's not the one we had.
Yeah, I had shame. I had guilt. I didn't get. Yeah.
I never heard that God loves us.
So, how did that? You mentioned it. You mentioned there in a joking way, but how did religion inform your kind of your early conception of like sexuality and sex? Was it like I just said there, shame and guilt? What was the relationship between the two like?
Yeah, I guess it's something like you don't realize until way later when you look at it because it's so normal when you grow up. But Irish people, even now, there's so many people that have like are covered in shame with sex. Like some people like that can only have sex when they're drunk or when the lights are out. So I feel like, I don't know, I was a very like horny child and it's in the book. And I felt like a lot of shame about that. Because I felt like boys were allowed to have sexual desire, whereas in girls, were it was supposed to just be done to them.
Mm.
Like, we were supposed to just, it's like, oh, there's the boy who wants to fuck me. I don't enjoy this, but oh, I guess I'll do it because I'm just a girl. And so the fact that I had those desires, like, I felt really ashamed of that. And I was always masturbating. But I remember, like, even when I was 20, saying to friends that I didn't masturbate. Nobody admitted. I remember in college, yeah, we were having sex and still nobody was like, yeah, I finger myself, whatever. You know, it was, that had like more shame to me than sex. But I remember saying when I was younger that I wasn't gonna have sex till I was married. And my mom was like, well, maybe just wait until it's someone you love. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna have sex. I went through like a religious stage. But it was all for attention. I went Protestant, which is like such a thing for attention. Because it was like the word, that's the word. My mom was like, anything but a Protestant, anything. And I was like, no, I believe. And like, I made her drop me down to like Protestant mass every Sunday. And she's like, the shame. She was so upset. Then when I told her.
How old were you at this time?
It's like 15.
Good.
And I got a Bible.
Nice.
And I used to read the Bible in school. Like, it was just all for attention. I would be reading my big Bible in school, and I was in Old English. I didn't know what was going on. I tried to start from the beginning, and then there's some story where like Lot, I think he has sex with his daughters or something. I was like, Jesus, this is too much. But I was like, yeah, I'm a Protestant. And I like, to be fair, the Protestant mass way better than Catholic, way quicker. And the time I was there, they gave out, it was Easter, and they gave out little Easter eggs.
Mm.
That doesn't happen in Catholic, so I love that. I used to meet with I'm saying the wrong words, whoever the Protestant priest and his wife was.
Vicar, I think, yeah.
Met with them a few times.
Yeah.
Yeah, where I was like, let's talk shop.
Let's talk about being Protestants together.
Yeah, it's just fucking attention to work. So I did that for about 6 months. And that was when I was like, I'm not having sex till married, which it feels like more a Catholic thing than a Protestant thing. But that was around, remember like all the celebrities used to have their purity rings and I was obsessed with America, so I think part of that was in it too.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was like, I'm not gonna do it till I'm married. And then I just read that book, The God Delusion, which now I think is a stupid book too, But at the time, I was like, whoa. So I was like, I'm an atheist now. My mum was like, thank God you're not Protestant anymore.
She would rather you were an atheist.
Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. In the book, you describe feeling more of a, you're talking about your mum there, but you also describe a really deep, a deep and meaningful kinship with your father.
Yeah, I was growing up, I was like very close to my dad, and he was quite mentally ill, but that was during a time that we didn't have those words for it. So the only word we had was like mad or crazy. So it was like, oh, that's just how dad is. Dad's mad, dad's crazy. Whereas in now, I feel like you'd have 900 words for it. So he got progressively worse, but during my early childhood, his like craziness was really fun because he was so unlike other parents. Like he was just, you know, he'd be like, want to skip school today and go, you know, for a salmon dinner. He was always bringing me to these really expensive dinners because he told me that like credit card is not real money. If you put on a credit card, he said it was magic money. And he said, you just put everything on your credit card. This is what he taught me when I was like 10. And I wonder why I'm bad at money now. He was like, credit cards are magic money. You put it on your credit card, you get a few credit cards. Then when you've got like 10 grand on each, you go and you negotiate and you say you'll only pay 1 grand. And they'll say, yeah.
The man's a genius.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, really? Okay. So that was my like financial advice. So he just, he was always doing mad things. It was really fun as a kid. And he was an alcoholic, but he spent most of my life sober. He would just go like have drinking binges like every few years. So that was like more his identity alcoholic than like anything mental illness. Cause we didn't even, nobody talked about depression. In like the 90s or like early 2000s, it was just people were, you know, mad or they're not. So it was that to me, that was just how my dad was. And we were very alike in a lot of ways. And then he just slowly got worse. And it's hard to like pinpoint in a person when they're like slowly losing their mind because they're still them and it's not an injury that you can like point out. So he got worse. And then in my, I think it was like 14, we had like our big falling out where he attempted suicide after we had a fight. And I felt it was blamed on me because we had this big fight and I was like, I fucking hate you. Like he had started drinking again. I was like, you're a cunt. Like everything I could think to say to hurt him, I said. And then he like tried to kill himself that night and called me into his room and had me like write out his will on a receipt, which was just the most ridiculous, like dramatic bullshit, which was classic my dad. But like, that's not binding, surely. It was the back of a Tesco receipt.
Yeah, I don't think it is legally binding.
And also, I don't have this in the book, but like when I was writing out that will, he gave most to the dog. Like,
I think he might have been just fucking with you.
Yeah, like it.
Okay, come and write my will on this piece of paper. And by the way, everything's for the dog. Now get out.
Yeah, it was. But also, he had nothing. Like, what? You're going to give your credit cards to the dog? Like, he didn't have any money either. So it was this big dramatic thing. And like, he had told me what he'd done. And then, like, the ambulance was called. And then the next day, I was in school, we were doing our mocks, and which is like the pre-exam, whatever. And like, I didn't know if he was dead or alive. And then the next night he came home, stayed drinking. So that was like, that was the focus. Like he's drinking, you can't talk to, then he got sober. And then it was just never mentioned. And I had like so much anger in me, but I didn't know how to express that because I was 14. So that like fractured our relationship and it never got back to where it was. Like it was, we made up, we were okay for a bit. He started drinking again a couple of years later. I stopped talking to him for like a year, which we lived in like a tiny 3-bedroom house. Like that takes a lot of effort to ignore someone when, you know, you're going by them on the landing. But then we did make up. But it was still, it was just, it never got back to the way it was. And I think in my head, I just always assumed that day would come, you know, where we would have that big Hollywood moment of like, he would realize how he'd hurt me. I could say my piece, he'd say his piece. There'd be like, you know, this big, like, he would be crying, you know, all that shit. And it didn't come because there's not always time for that. Like, people can die before that comes, which is a crazy thing to think of, because you do just imagine, like, when a person dies, like, that they've reached like peak wisdom and we could just die right now and just die how we were. We never got back to the closeness that we were. And I think I just always had this like barrier up with him from then, where I like treated him like I kept him at a distance. And looking back now, I wish I didn't do that, but I mean, it's easy to say that now. Where he got very like mentally ill. He was always like he used to always make up that he had illnesses. He would lie a lot about everything, sometimes really fun, and he'd make up he had illnesses. But there was a time that was really fun because he said he had like diabetes and he said he had epilepsy, but he used to get the two confused. So he would always use it to get out of. So like my brother came home one night, he'd just been like in the police station. He was like 14. He got in trouble. My dad hated like punishing us, so he had like an epileptic fit. We didn't really have epilepsy, but my brother was like, I thought it was real. I was like, oh my God, what's happening? And my brother was like, this has happened before. And so he just got a Snickers and stuck in his mouth, and then dad was back to life. But I was like, that would be the diabetes, not the epilepsy. So he just got himself confused.
The cure for epilepsy has been right under our noses this entire time, in every corner shop around the country. How do we not fucking figure this out?
Just Snickers. So those ones were fun. But then he would say he had cancer. He didn't have cancer, but he used to like say he had cancer, but like the doctors couldn't detect it because it was a really like, I don't know, sneaky one. But like he would be like, sometimes he'd wear crutches, but he didn't need the crutches. Like it just like slowly deteriorated so much. And I mean, towards the end, I remember having a conversation with my mom where she was like, I wonder if he has a brain tumor because he's so different right now. But it was a mental illness. And yeah, he died when I was 23. And even though now I do say like, oh, if I could do it again, I would be kinder to him. I would not be like so black and white. But I think when you're a kid, things are black and white to you. So when your parent lets you down for the first time, like, or maybe this was just me, but I treated him like a villain because you don't know that people are people and we're good and bad and everyone's gray. You think like there's good and there's bad. And so when your parent lets you down, you're like, oh, are you bad? And so I definitely overly punished him and was like, very harsh to him. But me saying, oh, I'd have done things differently, that's with the benefit of his death, but that's what like the process of his death has got me to here. So maybe if I had another chance, I wouldn't have been, because maybe it took his death for me to like gain more empathy for other people. I'm not sure. I'm saying it like there is the option right now. You're like, you can go back and we have a time travel. Joe has built one. Joe himself.
Maurice, it's funny you should mention it. Behind the curtain, we're standing right now. It's interesting to hear you talk about it as this period, this process of reflection that you're having now, and you've clearly thought about it a huge amount. And then the book, the sense that I almost got from it, at least in the immediate sense, was that process was actually kind of slightly more a transferal of addiction, maybe a little bit of depression, that the transfer, instead of being sort of one of, you know, being able to step back from it and then look at the whole thing and how it's impacted you emotionally, it's almost like you were caught up in the storm of it, if that makes sense. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I was so destructive in my 20s, and I mean, it's so obvious. Like, my dad died and suddenly I'm attracted to old men. Like, it's not rocket science. But yeah, I was like wild in my 20s. And I guess it depends like what mood you are when you like look back on things you do, because you can like have like a few different angles and like why you did something. depending on like what day it is. But I know like I had depression from when I was 14. And I had a few good years in my early 20s, and then I came back. And I had this weird philosophy that like, because my dad committed suicide, that's almost me, like gives me a right to do it. Like it gives like a legitimacy to it. So I was like convinced I was going to kill myself. Like that was, it wasn't 19. I was like 100% I will kill myself. And so I did like loads of mental things because I was like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what I do because I'm for sure going to kill myself. So, you know, like the sleeping with the old man for money, I did that being like, there's no concept. I definitely won't be alive, but I definitely won't write a book where I talk all about it. So I think like at the time I didn't realize this, but like, I think I did all this doing like a lot of drugs because like it made me feel something. Like the old men, like it made me feel like alive and during a time where I wanted to die. So like it was like an addiction. Like it gave me that same feeling, whatever that like rush is. Like when I would get money afterwards, I would get that same feeling. And not to like condone having sex with money or for money, but like out of all of them, it's not the very worst. Because I'm like a lot of them will kill you. That one will kill, unless you get like a bad guy.
There's so much in that I want to talk about. So I might be like going backwards and forwards a little bit here, but could you talk a bit more about that feeling of getting the cash, getting it in your hands and how it made you feel?
Yeah, I was absolutely sick.
What was the first bit of cash you got?
The first one was that guy who I never met who paid for me to go to Hawaii, and then he also just sent me $1,000, and I never met him, so I was like, nice.
Yeah.
So the first, I can't remember, because it like escalated. So it started with me like just dating older men and like they pay for everything, and then, you know, then you'd be like, oh, will you buy me this handbag? Don't even wear handbags, but like, you know, buy me this $2,000 handbag. And then like you get a rush from that, but then eventually like you have to keep pushing it and pushing it until you're like fucking strangers for money, because you don't get the same high from just like dating a guy that you're kind of into anyway, and he's like, we'll pay your rent sometimes. So like it was an escalation, but it was such a thrill. Like I try and describe it, and again, like not condoning it, I was in a bad mental place, and now I'd never do it, you know, don't go out and do it. But how I describe like going the sex for money versus like having sex not for money, like sex now, it's like eating a Cornetto, but like without the chocolate bit at the end. Like that's what the money was. It's not the main bit, but it's the best bit.
Yeah, fuck me. Like, so good.
Like imagine you're having sex and then any sex, like good, bad, whatever. And afterwards, someone just handed you $1,000.
Yeah, so the icing on top of the cake is...
Yeah, you'd be absolutely flipping home. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was so fun. And I never felt like in any... Like, I never felt a negative with the money. And even, like, I'm very blessed, like, thank you, Lord, but I'm attracted to ugly men. So... Like genuinely.
Well, not in your view, they're not ugly, right? Or do you think they're ugly? But
oh, I know.
I know, honey.
I'm not blind. I can see they're ugly, but like that does it for me.
Right.
Every so often I'll go out with a guy that's not ugly and I'm like, how did you slip through the cracks?
How'd you get in?
Yeah. I am into ugly guys. So that like, a lot of the guys I was into, like a lot of them I would have had sex with anyway and wouldn't have told them that, but I was like, what the fuck do you for free, bro? I've got a dead dad and I'm into ugly guys. You knew.
I was going to ask you that, whether you were into it or not, because I guess kind of the sort of, definitely the way the media kind of portrays having sex for money is, so in like the mainstream, I'm thinking of like, I don't know, Secret Diary of a Cool Girl or things like that, you know, those TV series, you kind of think they picture it as this basically like a woman who understands that she can sell sex, but she doesn't enjoy it. And she kind of in varying shades, and, you know, she gets the money and then she's kind of empowered and independent. And I'm I'm really interested that from what you said there that you'd happy have slept with some of them without the cash.
Yeah, like, but let's not go crazy. I wasn't enjoying the sex. Like, it wasn't
okay,
like an orgasm. Like, let's not go wild here. Like, actually, it was so, like, there was one guy that I was like, it was so into, and he looked like he was my age. He was 25, but he looked like Louis C.K. looks now. Like, he was
25, Louis C.K. looking motherfucker.
Yeah, he was bet. Like, he was wrecked. And, like, poor I was plug. So into him that I had to delete his number afterwards because I was like, I actually think I'll fall in love with this guy. Like, so sometimes it was really good. Most of the time, it was just whatever. But another skill I figured that I had was, like, I can have sex with anyone. Mm. Like, I just detach. Like, it's, I mean, maybe not a skill.
Rab sounds a little bit like trauma. I don't know. Is that a skill?
He hasn't just thinking glass half full here. Yeah.
I just, like, disassociate and I'm, like, totally not here, not present.
Amazing.
Cool.
So this is before like charcoal was a thing. Mm. This is 2014. So we didn't have
no one traumatized back then. Yeah. Famously.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so let's take it from perhaps being that kind of maybe not like the enjoyment side of the scale of things, but like complete other side of it, feeling unsafe, being put in danger.
I mean there was like one or two cases, and what the one that's in the book, I knew, like, I had a feeling, like, I knew there was that this was a bad, unsafe situation, and I continued in it because I was in such a destruct, like, I didn't care, and I almost wanted, like, bad things to happen to me all the time. But in general, like, I would say 99% were not dangerous. They, like, a lot of them were, like, entitled and lonely and annoying. And all of them had an opinion on World War II. Like, we get it. There's nothing left to say on World War II.
Think about Operation Barbarossa Boss.
We've got everything. We know everything there is on World War II. But one time I went on a first date and I got a bad feeling of the guy. He like grabbed my hand under the table and like pressed my wrist, and he just kept pressing it. And I was like, what are you doing? And he was like, I want to see how much pain you can handle. So I left that day, and I'd ordered, like, I always talk about it, but I love Wagyu beef so much. And again, this is back in 2014. No one was eating Wagyu beef back then.
Yeah, sure.
Like, kings were.
Yeah. But, so and I'd, you.
Yeah, me. I ordered a steak and I left before it came. So that really showed
That's a high bar.
I was like, I better. That's weird. The wrist thing is weird.
That's fucked up.
Yeah. So that one was, and I got a good feeling, so I left. And the only other bad good feeling I had was, I talk about it in the book, and I purposely did not leave because I was in such like a bad head. Sometimes I feel like when you're like really depressed, you want bad things to happen to you because then you have like an excuse to feel that way instead of just like, I'm depressed and I don't know why I feel this way. If you have bad things happen, then it's like, well, look, this bad, now.
Is this okay. The one in Amsterdam where you go in the nuts? Sorry, yeah. Could you tell the story? Sorry for people who aren't familiar.
It was a guy, like, he had paid me, and we went up to his room, and it turned like a bit. He said he was like could kill me. Which, to be fair, every man can kill almost every, like, you guys are stronger, but like, you don't need to be saying that to us. We all know. Don't need to announce it.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. It's a funny way of putting it, but it's not funny.
So it was like nothing actually that bad happened. It was more like it was a bad experience, and that I knew was going to be bad. Like, I had that good feeling. So afterwards, it was more of like, why did I put myself in that position? Like, why did I not leave when I saw alarm bells and felt that? And it was less about him and more like, why am I trying to seek this out? Like, why do I almost want someone to hurt me? And then I can say, like, I have been hurt, not by myself, by something else. But that was just one experience. Like, most of them were, a lot of them were really nice. Some of them were like fun. Like, there's one guy that I still kind of talk to every now and again, and he'll be like, oh, the kids have gone to the college. And we're like, Leia's gone to college. They grow up so fast. So most people, like, most people are not bad. Besides that one kind of like scary experience, like, the hardest part was like the conversation, like the having to sit across from them at dinner and listen to their opinions on everything. And, you know, you just kind of, I mean, I was drinking then, so like, you can kind of make it a bit fun, but like, that was hard.
Having to convince them that you're like into it or enjoying yourself, or
yeah, which like, I can do a lot, but like, so many opinions on everything, and they do a lot. Like, they think you've never had an opinion, so they think they're making your life telling you this, of like, you're not going to believe this. Thank God you're sitting down, but you know, this is what I think of linen. And it's like, right, okay. Like, they think they're blowing your mind about everything you say, and you have to be like, oh no, are you going to buy me those shoes? Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay, I'll listen to this for a bit longer. Did it change your opinion of men?
It is how I've always hated men. No, I'm kidding.
No, did it change the way you saw men?
Yeah. So it really, like, even though I joke about it all the time, it definitely damaged my view of sex, because for a long time I did not view sex as like a loving thing. So once I like fell in love with someone, I'd be like, absolutely not having sex with you. So that created a lot of issues.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah, never wanted to have sex with someone I loved. And I think, yeah, I think it like comes back to my dad, not to be a cliche, but I don't agree with thinking this way, but like, a lot of times I find male vulnerability pathetic, and I don't like, I know that's a wrong way to feel. That's like, that's just my natural, like, when a guy cries, I get like, ugh. I had this ex, and his son was like really sick. And he called the ambulance, and he started crying, my ex, and I was standing, and he was telling me to call an ambulance, and I was standing in the doorway, and he started crying, saying like, daddy loves you. The son was like too old to be saying dad, like, the son was in his 20s, but like, obviously he was sick. It was like a, you know, emotional moment. And I just stood there, and I just remember thinking, you're pathetic. And I was like, I know this is so bad, I know, but that's what came to, like, so I had an issue for a very long time with male vulnerability. But I've talked through it in therapy. This is absolute catnip for a therapist, like,
I bet.
Yeah. And she was like, because the first time you saw male vulnerability, like, when you have a parent who's an alcoholic, when you're, the first time you see them vulnerable is going to be a bad state. So like, the first time I saw my dad vulnerable was him like pissing his pants, shit faced. So I think I've always associated it with, and I was like 5 or something, and I remember saying like, I hate you. It had that reaction in me then. So I think like, it all ties to that. But I have like worked through it in therapy. But I've had issues with that. And yeah, I think for a while, I like, because you kind of see like the ugliness in people when you do things like that. But then there was a lot of good too.
Well, it's not black and white, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I'm not expecting you to be like, yeah, this was amazing or this was terrible. It's there's nuance to it. Obviously there is. So, you know, there's no problem with that. I was going to say earlier on when you were first talking about sex and sexuality, sort of like as a younger person, and you described sex as something that sort of like boys do to girls, and the power dynamics of that struck me then and now, and I think it's kind of interesting in this context when we're talking about when you were having sex for money. How did that, when you're in LA, how did that change your view of sort of like power within sex, or did it reinforce what you thought before?
Yeah, I've always been obsessed with like power moves. Like I think everyone's doing a power move every second of the day.
That's the quote, isn't it? It's something like everything in the world is about sex, apart from sex. Sex is about power, or something.
Oh, really?
Something like that. Yeah,
that's a good one.
I'll write it down.
Yeah, maybe you.
I made it. It's me. It's Ollie Dugmore. TM.
But yeah, I love like. I'm just obsessed with power moves, and I'm very aware of like the power. Maybe I'm overly aware, like, and I think it's there sometimes when it's not. But like, I think women, we're told we have all this power, especially when it comes to sex. We're told women decide, like women have all the power. Like a man, you know, will fall on their knees. Like it's women that hold the power, and it's like. That's just shit men have told us so that we think, you know, we're amazing. But it's a man always has the power. I think I said now three times that men can kill us. But like bomb gone for a fourth. But there's always that, like, it's not a conscious thing, but like when men are stronger than women. Physically, and that is always in my mind. Maybe I need to get in therapy for that, but I'm always aware of that.
I don't think it's unreasonable. The story you just told, right, of being in that room in Amsterdam and knowing that feeling of, did you describe it as powerless in the book? I can't remember, but you described it was about realizing that even though you were strong, sort of for yourself, that compared to his strength was.
Yeah, because I kicked him in the balls, but he let me go, and I was like, I only got away because he let me go. Mm. Like if he wanted to, he could have killed me, and like that is always in my head. Of like, I just feel like the power that I know of, it's always men. And that's, I think it's because when I think of power, I'm thinking of like a very outdated idea, because women obviously have power, but like in that kind of like classical sense, it's men that hold it. And I mean, now it's not something I think about or care about as much, but I used to be obsessed with this idea of just like taking some of it, just taking like in any way. And
is that what it felt like when you were taking their money, that you were taking a bit of it?
Yeah, not even like taking the money, but like sometimes I would just do things to like, in my head, humiliate them or like be disrespectful. Like I'd order my Wagyu steak and I'd, you know, it's so expensive, it's per ounce, and I'd leave 2 ounces on the table, and I'd be like giving the finger, but not really. Like I was doing all this like bullshit to be like in my head of like, this is, you know, being like even ones that there was men that were like, you're only seeing me, right? And they would give me more money for that. And it's like, then I'd purposely have sex at another one like that day or something. Like it was this weird way of thinking where I was like, I must take some of their power. And that's not taking anyone's fucking power doing that, but I don't know, I think like now I don't think of any of that stuff at all, and like I live a way nicer life.
It's far more chill.
I was very chilled. Like I'm not into it. I don't think of power. I'm going out with someone who's my age, which is my mom is bloody delighted. He's actually 2 years younger than me, which is, I'm like, you don't know how crazy this is. Yeah. Is, and just like, there is that more like equal feeling of like, because I think I liked that in my 20s, that it was like so obvious with older men of like, look at this power imbalance. Like I didn't have to go searching, because in my way of thinking then was like, when you go searching, you're going to find rot everywhere. Everything's bad. Everyone is bad. The whole world is bad. Because that's just how I thought. So I was like, at least I can see with these guys where their bad is. I can, it's not going to come up and like guerrilla warfare me. But now I'm happy. So I don't think that.
Yep. I have a couple more questions about power, but just.
Do you think of as a man? What's your take on power?
In what way?
All of them.
I don't. It's difficult to talk about because I think you can very quickly fall into a trap of basically describing what has been like a quite negative stereotype of masculinity. So, you know, what are the first things you reach for? Provider, protector, you know, someone who's disciplined, someone who is just, and you're basically just describing like, you know, the patriarch that has existed in society and in families for a really long time. And that's not necessarily a bad thing as long as in your definition you don't preclude women from being able to be those things. I think if you were to try and say what is like the divine masculine, then I guess it's sort of those things, and with those things there is like power inherent in them, right? If you're going to talk about protecting your family or your friends or your community, I guess the thing that's tied up in all of it is about how you use that power.
Yeah, right.
I think that's the really important part. It's the responsibility. It's like you by being, I don't know, let's say physically strong, not mentally strong, like literally in the way you're talking, where you are able to physically dominate another person. Within that, there is a huge responsibility that when you're out in the pub, you're not like starting fights and killing people in the street. You're not taking girls home and having sex with them without their consent. You have there's a responsibility on you that even though you have that power to not exploit it against other people. And I think, well, I'm completely like ad-libbing here, so this might just sound like horse shit, but I think it's kind of beholden on us. I think I think the reason why someone like Andrew Tate, for example, has this like hold over men is because he tells them the truth that they are powerful, like in that sense, and then tells them no one can dull your light. Like, you are who you are. Don't let the fucking feminists, don't let them dress you up as a girl, you know, all this transgender ideology. And the first part I think is true. Like, you should recognize the things that are true about men. It's the second part where the problem is, where it starts becoming like deeply misogynistic, where it starts becoming like really problematic. And actually it's having that, knowing what's right, knowing the right thing to do, and then being responsible enough to do it, I think is where we fall off a little bit. I think that's where it is.
I really like that, because I was like, how are you going to answer this? Because as a man, I was like, if you pretend there is no power, I was like, that will be annoying. And then if you're just like, you know, get our fucking power. But your answer was, I was like, how is he going to get out of this? And like, your answer, I thought that was really good about the responsibility thing.
Get out of it? I don't know. Yeah, it's...
No, you're not going to get out of it. It sounds like it's trying to trick you.
No, I know. It's really difficult because, I don't know how instructive it is to kind of pretend that the stuff you're talking about, it's so visceral when you're talking about it, because it's literally happened to you. Do you know what I mean? You've been in those situations where you've felt powerless, and we keep talking about this moment in Amsterdam, right? It is dark, so we don't need to keep talking about it. But the fact that the reason you got away was because he let you, like, that is really heavy.
Yeah. And I think that, like, weighed on me for... Well, maybe not for that long, so it's on to whatever next fucked up thing I was doing at the time. But it's that realization.
Let's go.
It's that realization that I think every woman has a lot of, like, he let me go there. Like, that feeling, and it's like a terrifying feeling. I understand why people almost want to pretend it doesn't exist, because it's scary to acknowledge that. But then when you don't acknowledge it, then you have the people like Andrew Tate who can rise up by saying like what begins with like a correct thing, but then you like attach all this horrible evilness to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because there's like that vacuum, because people are like, no, everything's equal, it's all good. And then when you're in a real life situation where you like feel that if you've gone not your whole life, but if you've gone like a long time being like, I'm powerful and I have just as much, you know, strength as this person. And then when it's like just taken from you, like so quick like that, you don't really know what to do or where to look. And you're just like, shit, this could happen anytime. Mm. Like this can.
I think the important thing for me is equal value. I think that's really important. Like the equal value that every human being has, but we are different. It makes no sense to me to say we are all the same, because it's just objective, you know, it's not true. I can't carry a baby in my stomach.
And, yeah.
You know, well, you can't carry a baby in your stomach either. It's in your womb, but you know what I mean?
I was like, what do you know about me? Oh my God.
That'd be so dark. No. But like, we have differences, and it's just, I think, if you deny those things that are patently true, then it's really easy for there to be a counterculture where someone will come along and point it out, and then he's got this, and then it slides into that sort of really dark misogyny.
Yeah.
So the question I was going to ask you was about like empowerment, like whether what you were doing in LA, whether it was, I guess there's two sides to this, whether you felt empowered at the time and then looking back on it now, whether you still feel the same way.
Yeah, no and no. So I feel like I'm on neither side, because I feel like with sex work, there's like two quite vocal sides of like, sex work is work and, you know, it's all totally normal and there should be no stigma and it's empowering. And then there's the ones that are like, sex work is rape and, you know, there's no agency from the woman. And this is just my personal opinion and my personal experience with it. But like, I'm not on either of those sides, because I think for me, it was my choice to do it. I could have not done it. I was not forced into it. I made the active decision to do that. Maybe I didn't understand the consequences of it. Maybe like I was in a bad head, whatever. Like I chose to do that. And I find it annoying when I see things online saying that women don't have that choice and that it's, you know, there are times when they don't. That is horrific, but that is not the case for everybody. And so when I read someone telling me that my experience was not my choice, that annoys me, because I'm like, yes, it was. It might not have been the right choice. Other people, it was still my choice to do it. And there are so many different with sex work. There are people that are trafficked. That's horrific, but that is not the same as what I was doing. So to equate them all the same, or that's probably the wrong word to equate, but to put them all in the same, to me, doesn't really make sense. But then the people that say sex work is just work and it's empowering and it's this, maybe for them. For me, that was not the case. It was not empowering. It was a thing I did that made me feel like alive. It was fun. It was a thing I did though to be destructive and to like get like a high. And it did, like, as much as I say like, oh, it was great, and you know, most of them were great and stuff, it changed how I viewed sex. And that has been a really difficult thing to try and overcome, and I don't think I'm fully there of, and it's taken like a lot of therapy. Like, it's been an issue in like relationships, and that I'm like, that wouldn't be happening if I worked in Tesco. Like, it's not the same. It's not just regular work. Like, there is consequences to it when you do something like that that you might not feel at the time and could come way later. And it's not the worst consequences out. Like, it's not something where I'm, you know, like, oh, this is the most horrific thing, but it's something that like I have to deal with and I would prefer not to deal with. I would prefer, if like I'm in love with someone, to be like, take your pants off because I want to do this. And that was not the case for years. That was not like that. It's taken like a lot of work for me to like try and reprogram my brain to viewing sex as like a thing you do with someone you love. So yeah, I would not call it empowering at all. No.
Mm. Can we talk about the logistics of it a little bit? Not the,
yeah,
but like
my Uber account. Like, what?
When a mummy and a daddy love each other very much. No, like the transaction,
Yeah.
The actual like getting paid, like how before, after?
Every man is different. One guy gave me a check. I was like, who the fuck is still writing checks? He was old as shit. He was like 70. But he wrote me a check. I was like, what am I supposed to do a check, man?
What's on sex with a 70-year-old man like? Are you like worried about possibly killing him or maybe not 70, maybe a bit older, but.
No, that never crossed my... Well, we're in LA as well, so like people do look good for their age. Still, what's good for 70, 60, still old. That guy was so... He'd taken loads of Viagra. He didn't tell me that, but I knew it because I was like, you should not be lasting this long. So he gave... Because a lot of times... It was different with each one. A lot of times he had to do a little dance because they would be like, this is not about the money, right? Because you had to like pretend it's not like a transactional thing, and that's why they would like give you maybe more than it would cost like an escort or a prostitute. You would get like more money, but then you have to like buy into the lies that it's not about the money and right. It's just you like their company and they just so happen to give you money. So some of them, like there was one guy, I didn't get anything from him for like 6 months, and then I had college tuition to pay. Not so he gave me like 20 grand, so I got like, but that's a long play.
Yeah
whatever is that a sporting term or whatever that was a, or like a, in stocks that would be like a asset or whatever. But then some of them, especially once I got in like maybe 6 months into it, and you get more like confident and also like you want more of like a risk, so some I'd be like straight up front, like I want X amount. I would vary all the time. Sometimes it would just vary on my mood or like what I think I could get. Like I've had sex with some guys for like $500, I think was maybe the least. Yeah, for like a one time, like they would give it afterwards. I think that was another thing. Now that you've asked me that, I'm like, oh, it was always afterwards. And I think that's probably another little mind thing they had in their head of like, oh, because escorts get it beforehand, then it's not escorting. But it was always after. I had one guy who I would see him all the time, like every few weeks, and he'd give me an envelope afterwards. And it was always different amounts every time. And I was like, is this performance based? Like, no, they didn't ask. I never brought it up.
There's a bonus on top. There's flat fee and there's a little bonus.
Yeah. Like, one time I got 1500, one time I got 900. And I was like,
wow.
That's a bit of a...
That's a big discrepancy.
I mean, but still, like, still good, and like, for whenever an hour's work, but I had no idea what he'd put in, and, like, some guys would pay, like, a monthly amount, so those guys, like, if they'd pay me a monthly amount, then it would be, like, a game of cat and mouse that month, where I'd do, like, everything to try not see them for the month. Like, my dad died a lot during that time. I was like, you're not going to believe this.
Back to Ireland.
Yeah.
He's only gone and died again. Yeah. He's only gone and died again. Sorry. Oh, I told you earlier. Terribly sorry about that. You said in one of those answers there that you were like an hour's work. So would you see multiple men like in a day, just like?
No. It wasn't really an hour. Not really, because like you
got to go for dinner and shit.
LA is a big place too, like an hour to get there. You go out for dinner. I would never spend the night because I can't sleep next to someone like that. But no, it would not be an hour. I know, actually, one guy was an hour. I was so into him. I wanted it longer. it's always how it goes.
The one that got away.
Yeah. But I'm sure if that was your focus of like, I want to make money, you could like make fuckloads. But I'm a lazy person in general. Like, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, I'm not going to be doing a lot of it. And also, I was, you know, getting fucked up and like doing, you know, I had other hobbies. And like, all the money I got, I just spent immediately. It's not like I was saving it or like doing anything productive with the money.
Surprising when you lessons in financial responsibility where the credit cards are the magic money. Who could have seen that happening?
Yeah, I found new magic money.
did they ever ask you to do like mad stuff, or was it literally like almost like girlfriend? They were looking for companionship. It was like, let's go for dinner and then.
Yeah, well, companionship and sex. None of them were just, that's another like myth that like you'll see on those TV shows. They'll be like the one guy going for, not one guy has ever. They'll have him in a wheelchair or something, and then just because he's in a wheelchair, he's looking for companionship. No one is looking. then they'll go hang out with their mates. Like, yeah. It's such a stupid thing they put on TV shows about it. No one is ever really into anything weird. One guy was like, will you pee on me? So I did that.
Not much.
$500, but no sex. It was just peeing on. But I more did it because I was like, I've never done it. I'll do it once. And we're in a hotel room. And so he was like, I just want it on my chest. But I had drank like loads of wine because I was like, I don't know if I can do this. And then loads of water because I didn't want my pee to be yellow. I didn't want to be like pee shamed. So I was bursting. And so I was like squatting over him and I started peeing and it went on for so long. And like I felt so much power. Like I was like, this must be what men feel all the time. And then I was like, I can do what I want. And I angled up my pee in his face. Yeah.
What did he say at that
He was
point?
Like, ah! Yeah, he's basically waterboarding. He was like, "Whoa!" And then afterwards, he just got in the shower and he didn't bring it up, but he didn't see me again. But I wasn't gonna do that regular. I was peeing on someone all the time, like just a treat.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels too on the nose to be like that. There was kind of like a bit of typical male female like role reversal in that situation, and that's why he kind of felt like, I don't know, not ashamed, but like can almost bring it up, couldn't even say I asked you not to do that. But
yeah, although if your thing has been peed on, it's like I would assume like you're into shame.
You're probably quite into it.
Yeah, so maybe he was like, yes,
still coming.
Yeah, maybe it was reverse psychology. He was like, oh please don't piss on my face, I would hate that. No, oh my god, if I got tricked. Oh,
I mean, throughout this conversation we're talking about some like really dark heavy stuff and we're still laughing about it, right? And
yeah,
it's the same with Trouble, your book. It deals with some really heavy subject matter. What, first of all, how are you able to find the humor in this stuff? But then secondly, how important do you think it is as well?
I think really important. And I don't know, I'm like, I don't know if it's like a family thing or an Irish thing, but like people have always made jokes about everything. And I think it's so nice. I think it's like such a, I think it's such like a cute way that human beings deal with stuff. Like they, like something really awful will happen and they'll make a joke. That's adorable. I think that's so cute. Like when my dad died, like I remember the first joke we made and it was like that we found out like that evening and that night by the time we're back at my mum's house. I can't remember who said it. Maybe it was me, maybe it was my brother, but so my dad died by drowning and then we're like picking funeral music and someone was like, will we play Bridge Over Troubled Water? And it was like the first joke someone, and like that's me, I don't know, I think that's like, I think it's so cute that we deal with like horrible things through laughter. And when people say like, oh, you shouldn't joke about that, I'm like, it's adorable to we don't find it funny. Like I've had people before say, oh, like you're joking about suicide. Suicide's not funny. And it's like, obviously suicide is not funny. I'm not like, ha, 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 ha. Like it's trying to find a joke to laugh when you're going through something really hard. And like that first laugh you get when something really bad happens, because like there's a part of your brain that's like, okay, that's it. My life has changed. I'll never laugh again. And when you get that first laugh, it's like, I don't know, like hits you. It's like your first like roller coaster or something where like it just feels so good of like, oh my God, everything like will be okay. Like I can still laugh. Like the world keeps turning. So I really like making jokes about hard stuff. I try and be like more respectful now that like other people don't like it. And so I try and only do it to like my own experiences. And I understand when people maybe get offended by that, or because maybe they've gone through something similar and they think you're laughing about that. And like, so I understand when people don't like that, but for me, I love it. And I think it's such a nice like way that we've figured out as human beings to like get through something. Yeah, I like it. Do you like dark humor? I mean, yeah, you've sat here and laughed at my pain.
I've been giggling away as you poured your heart out. Yeah, so I think, yeah, I probably do quite like dark humor. Maurice, go on. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Much for taking the time. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, man.
Cheers. Thank you.